From ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania, Leon Compton.
A couple of months ago, we were asking you a whole host of questions about a time of changing climate. It's happening now. So what's it going to mean for fire? I'm always struck by talking with Evan Rowley, who spent his lifetime sort of in and around the forestry sector and lives down at Castle Forbes Bay when those fires were coming through in the early part of the year. And just him talking about the fact that, you know, fires used to start and then a few days later they would be out. But this was weeks and weeks and weeks, not just of the emotional stress of not knowing what was going to happen, but the idea that the fires weren't being properly extinguished, that they were still in the landscape, that there was a threat that they were posing, and so on. What else is an issue for you? Lots of questions came in on Curious Climate, and we've asked some expert panellists to come in and talk with them as part of our collaboration. Sandra White's Director of Community Fire Safety at the Tasmanian Fire Service. Sandra, good morning to you.
Morning, Leon.
Thanks for coming in. I think you like the look of some of those questions.
I do. I think they're great questions.
David Bowman's Professor of Pyrogeography and Fire Science, Director of the Fire Centre Research Hub at the University of Tasmania. You joined us from Darwin this morning. David, good morning to you.
Oh, hi, how are you going?
I'm excellent. And you've got Sandra here. I think you two know each other pretty well, am I right?
Yep.
If you have a question, dear listener, throw it around 1300 222 936. Love to hear from you. Your curious climate question this morning, 1300 222 936. Questions on fire in the landscape in a time of changing climate. Look, to both of you, you know, you can't see each other, so please grab the conversation, run with it. I manage a property. This is a text, or rather a question for the Curious Climate panel. I manage a property in a forested area on the eastern slopes of Mount Dromedary. How is that's between Bridgewater and New Norfolk, if you don't know. How is bushfire risk likely to change in the next 10, 50 and 100 years, how is the number of severe, extreme and catastrophic danger rating days likely to change? That's grist for both of you, I think. Sandra, let's start with you. Good question. How's that risk likely to change?
It is really likely to change. It is going to increase. We've worked pretty closely with the ACRC and with the Bureau of Meteorology, and we've been doing climate forecast modelling, specifically looking at the fire danger question and projecting what changes in fire danger will look like right up until over the next 100 years. And what the trends show is very clearly that for those areas in Tasmania that are already some of our highest fire danger areas, and that Dromedary, New Norfolk, Derwent Valley area certainly already sits in one of our highest fire risk areas, it's going to increase. There's no question of that. So the number of days that are in that very high and above fire danger sort of level are going to increase. The change in that projection, it looks like it could grow, you know, over the next 100 years, we're looking at an increase in total fire ban days over summer, but perhaps up to 75% over the next 100 years. And that is, you know, it's real. That's what's happening, and we're seeing it. And that's what we've obviously experienced over the last couple of fire seasons, that change in the increase in number of very high and severe fire danger days.
Is that a function of just a greater awareness, more risk aversion, better preparedness from fire services? Or is it literally that there are more times when a fire in the landscape is likely to be, you know, catastrophic or extreme and so on?
So I think we've got to be really careful about our language. Mm. So there's the way we talk about fire danger, which is an analysis of what the climate is and what the conditions are. And then a fire's impact might be what we would consider catastrophic, but if we're talking about catastrophic fire weather, that actually means something to us as an industry about a set of conditions. Mm. And so if I'm thinking about this as very much as a climate question, and it is real, so there's going to be an increase in temperature, which is one of the drivers behind the fire danger ratings and fire danger index, and a decrease in relative humidity. And so when you start putting those things together, you start to see a change in what the fire danger is. And also, one of the things that's part of the change of climate that they're modelling is a change in rainfall patterns. And so that means that the fuels are drying out, so there's more fuel availability. And if you think about the fire triangle and fuel and heat and oxygen, you've just increasing the amount of fuel that you've got sitting there. And so that's another driver behind what's going to increase those climactic conditions. So regardless of whether or not there's a start, and I would agree, you could have a severe fire danger day, there's no starts, so we're okay. But the actual climactic conditions that are going to for that landscape and that climate are actually the modelling's quite clear that they're increasing.
David Bowman, let's pick 50 years from our listener's question. Mount Dromedary, Eastern Slopes between Bridgewater and New Norfolk. How do you see this issue in terms of bushfire risk in a time of changing climate?
Well, the way I look at it, I think Sandy's provided a very good frame, but there's the unknown unknown problem. And that is that the climate projections are very good at painting a big picture. And basically, it's very simple. We're warming, heating the planet, and there's going to be biological consequences. If you've got forests which are being heated and dried, you're going to get events where they're going to burn. And on the other side, at the very short range, we've really had these fantastic advances with meteorology. So meteorologists can give fire managers very good predictions about the danger of bushfires within, say, a week. But the problem we have is this exact question of, you know, what's going to happen in the next decade or the next five decades. You know, could I dial up a computer program and tell you the number of extreme potential bushfire events next summer or the summer after or in 10 summers' time? We can't. We don't know that. And there's lots of reasons why we probably will never know that. And this is the beguiling thing, that the community is being served two quite different messages. One message is a very scary future. And it is a very scary future. And another message is we've got a handle on this within a week, 2 weeks. We can actually see what's coming and we can help people get their minds around that. But really the adaptation step of what you should be doing if you're living up in mm-hmm. bushland country, which is preparing now for a very different sorts of future and different sorts of summers in the very near time, in the next, because that's how you're going to get out of trouble in 50 years. And it's a really difficult message to tell because we can't give you those precise numbers. They're just not possible because, you know, there are two really critical ingredients in Tasmania which affect fire risk, which broad climate projections are hopeless at dealing with, and that's wind speed and lightning. And they're the big ticket items in terms of a yes or no situation in a really major. And I might add, with the exception of Dun Alley, we haven't really realised the full potential of. And this worries me in Tasmania. What a really big, like last summer was not actually as bad as people think it was. It could have been many, many times worse had the winds. Oven dry winds from Central Australia. We just didn't get those winds. We were so lucky. And predicting those things into the future, those oven dry winds, very particular synoptic setup, and predicting when those lightning storms are going to come and getting all of the combinations lined up, very, very difficult problem, probably an impossible problem. So we're asking a society to prepare for a sort of a broad risk, which we can see we're on a heating planet and we're asking people to respond, and we do it really well with total fire bans and really good advisories. But it's this grey zone that we're really going to have to get traction with if we're going to adapt to the problem we've got.
David Bowman and Sandra White are our guests this morning, and we're putting questions that came up through our Curious Climate Project to them for you this morning. Let's move on to some of the other questions. And it ties into where we've started this morning. With predictions of drier and warmer climate and the probability of more dry lightning strikes, are there tactics we can employ to reduce the risk of devastating bushfires other than deforestation and constant fuel reduction burns, which are likely to exacerbate the drying of the local climate? Sandra, with the prediction of more lightning strikes, and as David mentioned, along with wind, it's one of the major issues. Do we need to change our firefighting strategies? Are there things that we can do to adapt?
Look, I think I just want to comment. I guess David's right in terms of we can look at climate impacts on a really broad scale, and then we're actually from the services we're getting from the Bureau of Meteorology are helping us from a week to week actually predict what the fire danger is like in an area. We are looking at our tactics, and I guess particularly post the summer that we've just had, obviously there's reviews and things going on, and I really don't want to preempt any of the outcomes of that review and get right into the detail of what some of those tactical questions might be. I would say that there are things that we do at a long-term scale, and they're things like how we design and build homes in bushfire-prone areas, and what we talk about BAL or BAL levels, bushfire attack levels, for how we design and build our buildings and how we look at the Australian standards for construction in bushfire-prone areas. And so they're some of the longer-term strategies that we're certainly looking at, how we use planning and how we can help provide good, robust advice.
Do you think we're going to see significant changes to house design? Do you think we're going to come to a point where councils say, sorry, you can't build there, it's up a small road, it's only one way in, one way out? No.
I think it's started to happen. I mean, we're not seeing no necessarily, but we are certainly seeing changes to house design. We're seeing changes in the design of eaves and gutters. We're looking at the type of glass that people use. So that there are certainly research projects that are happening with architects, and it's certainly happening in that space that we are looking and not just the fire services and the fire emergency response agencies, but even broader in the building industry, that they're looking at this problem.
David Bowman, adaptation of fire management responses to things like dry lightning strikes tactically that we might adopt. Do you see them?
Oh, absolutely. And we're doing some really exciting preliminary work with the City of Hobart, reimagining fuel management rather than just thinking that it's a matter of burning patches of fuel. We can actually do a lot more creative things. We're trialling green fire breaks, which is opening up the understory in wet forests, mulching basically, to try to decouple a fire that could develop and get into the crowns, and you know, a way of managing fuel using a combination of burning and machines and design. And my vision is to take the society, the community on a journey where we're going to actually agree on modifying the landscape. It's not going to be imposed top-down. It's going to be a community journey, and we're doing that with social scientists.
Give me an example of modifying the landscape and how it might occur around our population centres where they're abutted by forest.
Well, one of the things that a requirement is to have fire breaks, mm-hmm. and you know, fire breaks can be very boring, really. They're just, like, boring. They're just, you know, bulldozed strips of bare earth. But fire breaks actually can be, with imagination, turned into an amenity where they're parks, you know. And so just getting the idea of we're wanting to have a buffer, but rather than just sort of, you know, firing up a bulldozer and making a great big strip through the bush, we could actually start thinning out the bush, modifying the bush and coupling burning with the herbivores and creating marsupial lawns. And by accident, we've already done this around Hobart. We've got these fantastic marsupial lawns, some of our fire trails that were made after the 67 fire. And what I, you know, the big idea that I would like to explore, but you need social license with this. You need to tell the story of how the landscape's changed and how it will change and what options we have to adapt.
What about, two questions have come in about fire-resistant trees. Could we have green fire breaks made up of fire-resistant trees? And people have been asking that question in relation to surrounding plantations, but as you've extended it, to protecting communities. What do you reckon, Sandra? Well, and David?
I'll throw that one to David, yeah.
Yeah, no, but just to pop in about they already exist, and they're called the creek lines. And we've got this opportunity in Hobart, the creek lines, we could irrigate them because the creek lines are going to be under stress as the water flows decline. And so this is sort of like, you know, the creek lines with leaves, plants are generally less combustible. But, you know, a creative idea is imagine running some irrigation lines around creeks and keeping them wet. And so they're nice, cool places to walk as well, and because we're going to have much hotter summers. So that's one example. But, yeah, you can plant or you can modify existing vegetation to favour some vegetation over others. Try to you know, one of the things they're doing in Victoria, it's called candling, where they have a flamethrower. I mean, it sounds very dramatic, but they burn all of the loose bark off eucalypts. And that's a really important strategy to reduce spotting from fires. So they, you know, they're driving along some of their fire trails and basically tidying up some of the trees on the fire breaks. So I think we're really going to be moving into landscape design, and this necessarily opens up a conversation about what natural is and what the indigenous landscapes were that got colonised.
Well, let's talk about that, because a lot of our listeners this morning are asking questions about indigenous perspectives on landscape management and what it is that thousands of years of fire management of the landscape by our first Australians might have to tell us. What is the answer? Where do you think, are there answers to be found in that heritage?
Yeah, look, there definitely are. And I think it's really important that we do look at that Indigenous heritage as well. We've had a project with the Truana Rangers on Cape Barron Island, where we actually have looked at how we can reintroduce cultural burning back and into Cape Barron Island, which is obviously owned by the community there. So they sent some of their people up to Cape York, where they looked at where they're still using fire stick farming practices there. And we've sat down with them, we've worked closely with them, we've provided them with some training in sort of our systems, but also we've learnt a lot. The staff that were involved sat down and learnt a lot from that community about the use of fire, how we look at a landscape and not think about seasons, not think about calendar months, but look at cues in the landscape. These particular plants are flowering, so that means we can do this type of burning. And it's been a really good outcome for Cape Barron Island. We've got a fire management plan there that's actually in Palawakani. And it's been a really nice collaboration working with that community, and certainly for us, working with landowners. Obviously, Tasmanian Fire Service is not a land management agency, so it's us working with the landowners in with their values and how they want to see things done. And there's certainly that Cape Barron story has been a fantastic one for our staff and for the Tasmanian Fire Service, but also for that community to actually have the confidence and to start to reintroduce some cultural burning practices onto Cape Barron Island.
David, what about around the major population centres? Those indigenous perspectives.
Well, that's right. One of the reasons I'm actually in the Northern Territory, I've been working with a traditional family for the last 20 years studying their fire use, and if I had to summarise it in one sentence, I would say it's lovingly tending the earthly garden with little fire. And what we're really going to have to do is bring back little fire. And little fire is safe, and it's in some ways very beautiful, and it can create biodiverse and heterogeneous landscapes. And we will have achieved that when we can do that around Hobart comfortably.
Is that achievable, David?
Absolutely.
I mean, the landscape of the Northern Territory is so well adapted to it. I mean, much of it is particularly flat. You've got a lower tree story and fewer people living amongst it.
No. This is one of the most astonishing things about Aboriginal culture in Australia, is that there is such... there are some general principles, yes. But, you know, I said little fire. I didn't say a specific. It's the little, the diminutive. But exactly what the scales of those fire are going to vary by environment. But as a generality, you can see that with Indigenous fire use, and the opportunities are occurring in Tasmania. We're also involved in a project in the Midlands, and the translatability. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do that project in the Midlands on a farmer's land. Is we talked about that, and he'd been up north, and we said, yeah, well, you know, there's actually, it's translatable, and we are translating it, we're doing it, and what's really cool about it is we're involving the Tasmanian Aboriginal community in this process, and that exchange, Aboriginal people have a very broader view, I think. They're less boxed in, maybe, than non-Indigenous people saying, well, this isn't, you know, this is Northern Territory, this is Tasmania, you can't do that. They're seeing a much more fluidity And, you know, cultural connections and cultural rekindling of fire. So there's a real opportunity, I think, that we can go back to the colonial paintings, we can go back to first contact, you know, impressions of explorers and colonialists, and we can start discerning patterns in the landscape, and the trick will be to be able to rekindle that. We're not in a program of going backwards. We're going forwards into a heating planet. But we need to take the tools and the inspirations from the indigenous culture and start applying them and adapting them as part of our solution.
Another question's come in this morning for our Curious Climate panel. Sandra White's our guest this morning, Director Community Fire Safety Division at the Tasmanian Fire Service, and David Bowman, Professor of Pyrogeography and Fire Science at the Fire Research Hub, University of Tasmania. Could we put lightning conductors on our major peaks around Tasmania to try and reduce the incidence of lightning strike? It's an idea that came in from one of our climate change climate panelists, or rather our climate our listeners. Anyone going to go for lightning conductors on the top of our on peaks in Western Tasmania or beyond?
Well, I guess my first comment is it's the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area. In a global context, having just got back from some personal travel overseas, the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area is really iconic globally. So it's of global significance. And one of the values that it's set aside for is its wilderness values.
So I'm trying to work out whether or not you're saying yes to lightning conductors or no, it wouldn't be a good look.
It wouldn't really be a good look, would it, across this remote wild landscape to have a whole series of lightning rods. The other challenge is which ridges are you going to pick? And the lightning doesn't just go in the ridges. Mm. It actually... experience from the summers, the last big lightning seasons we've had, and the number of strikes. So we had one event this summer just passed where there was over 2,000 lightning strikes. In the 2015-2016, where we had, again, we had a whole series of wilderness fires, we had several lightning events there, minimum 800 strikes. So these are ground strikes. This isn't cloud to cloud. These are actual strikes on the ground. And I think... The practicality of how many lightning rods we have to put and where we'd have to put them, I think, a bit of an impossible challenge.
It feels like a no. David, do you want to agree or disagree?
Well, you know, this is the classic geoengineering sort of hope. And you know, after the Second World War in the United States, you know, one of the origins of cloud seeding was the big idea that they could disrupt thunderstorms and stop lightning strikes. And of course, you know, they're great ideas. They're just completely impractical. And, okay. And they're not really dealing with the issue in hand. The issue in hand is that we have to create landscapes that have a capacity to withstand the global heating that's coming, the increased ignitions, and also the complexities of having enterprises and you know, important infrastructure and homes and lives embedded in flammable landscapes. And those solutions are going to be found, you know, at a very fine scale, the ground and the adaptive scale, not the big hope of going out into the wilderness and putting up some lightning conductors. We've really got to actually engage. Okay. It's that tending of the earthly garden, engaging with our landscapes. That's and our homes and our societies. That's how we're going to survive this.
Yeah, and on mornings around Tasmania, it seems that others are agreeing. But thank you for the question. It's an interesting idea. The Tasmanian Fire Service says a listener should be given a clear directive from government to put out all fires as quickly as possible with all resources available. Air tankers and dozers should hit fires early and altogether. The Central Highlands fire, for example, should never have burnt for 4 weeks, says a listener with some experience of that part of Tasmania. So let's sort of broaden that question. Are we going to need to see the evolution of more rapid response fire units to strike fires when they start in the hope of getting on top of them early? Sandra, it's your borough.
I'm happy to... it's putting Sandy in a difficult situation, but I'll broaden that. And I think one of the, again, it's another slippery slope of a total war on fire. Mm. Fire has a really important place in landscapes, but it's really the type of fire. So if you set up, and this was the tragedy that occurred in the United States of Smokey Bear, put every fire out by 10 o'clock, they ended up with this huge combustible forest, you know, problem, which they're still working through because they got overgrown forests. They had aversion to using other techniques than just, you know, building bigger and bigger armies to attack fire. So, yes, there is a place for rapid attack and for surveillance, but it's all going to have to be contextual about what's the risk. There's got to be judgments about the risk. You know, obviously, we don't want our Gondwanic heritage vegetation incinerated. We need to do preemptive treatments to try to make those landscapes more resilient and resistant to being burnt. That requires planned burning, but we also need to have capacity to go and put out fires when it's deemed sensible. Because if you get onto the treadmill of bigger and bigger aircraft and bigger everything, at the moment, you know, everybody cheers when that's happening until you get the bill. It's the morning after problem. The bill is just so stupendous. And what's happened in America is that the resources get drawn away from managing fuels and helping societies adapt because they're all going on emergency response. And we really need to manage that tension carefully because otherwise we'll end up in a place we don't want to be. It just gets worse rather than better. And that's really difficult for managers like Sandy to deal with because there are very strong competing, during a fire event, particularly strong competing drivers to respond, but also keeping your eye on the main game. This is a long-range adaptive program.
We've only got 7 minutes left to news at 10 o'clock, and what I'd like to do is just ask both of you to talk about and talk together about how you think life is going to change for Tasmanians between now and news at 10 o'clock. Are you happy to both? We'll have a message from our sponsors, and then we'll come back and just talk to people about how you think life will change, you know, in the same way that I'd be reluctant to choose a waterfront property that, you know, had the waves lapping against the, you know, the concrete reinforcements. Now, will people be reluctant to choose houses as deep in the bush as they are at the moment? What will it be like for tourism operators or people living down in Huonville who spend a month and a half with fire in their landscape and threatening communities, for asthmatics? So that's where we're going to finish the conversation this morning with Sandra White and David Bowman, and we'll do it after this.
Helen Shield.
Mama Alto, you always have these ornate flowers in your hair.
We were doing some special gigs up in Tennant Creek,
and one of the little children suddenly said to me, "Do those flowers grow out of your skull?" I said to him, "Yes, they do." And he said, "Oh, you must have a lot of beautiful ideas in your head if flowers grow out of your skull."
Your Afternoon with Helen Shield, weekdays on ABC Radio Hobart.
Leon with you this morning around Tasmania, David Bowman, Sandra White, our guest this morning. So really, what does the future look like for Tasmanians? For you listening to us this morning in Marawar or in St Helens, for you listening to us in the Northern Midlands Council area, or indeed at Cockle Creek, what's it like if you're one of the hundreds of thousands who lie their heads down every night in Hobart Town? David Bowman and Sandra White are our guests this morning. And that's how we're going to finish the conversation this morning, spending a few minutes talking about that. Sandra and David, let's talk together about the ways that you think life will change and we will adapt. What life will feel like, Sandra?
Look, I think the first thing is that what we need to understand is what we're experiencing right at the moment. It's not a new normal. So this isn't we're moving from one steady state to another. And I know, David, that you would agree with me on this, that this is... we're at the start of something here. So this bouncing to extremes, so really hot days, really cold events, and we're seeing it all around the globe right now. You know, when I was in the UK, the Welsh Fire Brigade were talking to me about dry lightning strikes in Wales. Now, they only had two, but it was the first time they'd experienced that.
And the stress, Sandra, of that week. So even here, my colleagues who live down past Huonville, that stress of day after day after day, are we going to evacuate today? Are we going to not evacuate today? Mm. That stress is going to be part of the life that we live.
I think, and it's not just about fire either. So what we're seeing with climate change is it's this bouncing to extremes. So rain's going to come, but it's not going to come in nice, steady patterns, but it's going to come in intense events. So an increase in flooding, increase in different types of storms. I think we are going to have to become a people that get used to living with a wild climate, a really wild climate around us, particularly where we are here in Tasmania at 42 degrees south.
David, what's life going to feel like, do you think?
Well, I want to put an optimistic spin on it. I think that this is a really exciting moment to be engaging with the environment. The environment's asking some really interesting questions of us, and it's our test of how we're going to answer those questions, how we're going to adapt, because, you know, really the forces we're dealing with are very big, and we can deny it and just pretend it's not happening, or we can just keep doing, you know, the same thing over and over again, believing that we'll get a different outcome, even though we won't, or we can adapt. And in that adaptive process, we're being shaped by the environment. We're becoming Tasmanians, or we're becoming Australians. It's a really cool thing that we, you know, the psychosocial stress, which is absolutely undeniable, we have to work with that stress rather than being crushed by it, make that animating communities to have conversations about, well, what do we want? What are we willing to tolerate? We're doing, as I said, a pilot study, social science pilot study in some of the bushland suburbs, and the response has been really fascinating. Contrary to the view that people would be hostile to interventions, they actually want them. They want to be safe, and they want changes in the landscape. So that conversation, I think, is really going to be exciting, that we're going to be able to design and create and come through this as a more coherent society.
Oh, the idea that there might be something more powerful, David, than lobbyists, industrialists and newspaper proprietors when it comes to this challenge. Sandy, do you want to get on board the optimism train?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would absolutely agree with David too. And one of the questions that people have sort of talked to me about is the resilience of Tasmania. And I would say, you know, I agree. Our communities are resilient. And we've shown that. And over the last, you know, if we keep going back, Denali, and then every 3 years we're having these big fire seasons and summers, huge resilience from those communities. It's been hard. I'm not going to deny the hardness of that. But I turn up to work in those days and we're putting in long hours, but everybody is motivated by the same passion and sense of wanting to work together and come together. And we saw that even over this summer. You know, the people, not just our volunteers, and I'm really proud of the Tasmanian Fire Service volunteers and the SES volunteers, but also people who were donating their paddocks so that people could relocate their horses and donating feed and how we come together as a community. And I think that's a great feature of Tasmania, is that we are a community and we do support each other. And I think that's why David's absolutely right. There is room for us to adapt.
To both of you, thank you for coming on this morning.